Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week of science straight into your ear holes and into your brains. My name is Claire and with me this week I have Chris. Hello.
Hello, Claire.
Hello. And I have Stu.
Hi, Claire.
And this week on the show, it's one of my favourite times of the year. There's a couple of favourite science times in the year, and this is one of them because the Ig Nobel Prizes have just been announced. And regular listeners of the show and regular appreciators of science whimsy would know the Ig Nobel Prizes as the hilarious cousins to the Nobel Prizes, the prizes that make you laugh. And then they make you think.
Just like Professor Frink.
Just like Professor Frink. Yes.
Yeah.
And this week we love them so much. We're dedicating a whole episode to it because there is some brilliant science and some hilarious science in here to tell you all about.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the thing that I love about the Ig Nobel Prizes is, yeah, they're weird papers that get published and they pull them out of, you know, there's something like 2 million plus science papers get published every year and there's some pretty wacky stuff going on. But these are real papers. This is not made up for lols. This is actual science that has been done for, you know, various reasons.
Yeah. And as everyone will find out when we get stuck into the stories, the research isn't necessarily just from this year. They have a wide net, a large, far-reaching net that they cast to be able to award the Ig Nobel Prizes on a yearly basis. So, I mean, should we just get stuck into it?
Totally.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go.
Now, I've often wondered how much of a part alcohol played in the conception of the Ig Nobel Prizes and how much of a role it plays in the actual ceremony itself, which does seem like a lot of fun. They do annually present these in person to people who are willing to show up and join in on the joke, I suppose. But as if to inflame my suspicions, this year's prizes have not one but two alcohol-related awards, one for aviation, which is of a biological kind. Yeah, oh. Booze and aviation. What we all want to know, how booze and aviation mix or don't. And the other is the coveted Ig Nobel Peace Prize, which I'll get to a bit later. But first of all, let's look at the aviation prize, or as I've taken to calling the paper for which it was awarded, Booze for Bats. Animals in the wild are known to consume fermented fruits as part of their diet, sometimes apparently on purpose. One paper recently showed that a population of chimpanzees consumed the equivalent of a full-strength beer's worth of alcohol every day.
Wow.
But it wasn't clear from that paper whether they consumed more on Fridays or on the weekend. They do seem to enjoy the effect of the ethanol in the fermented fruit. But one animal that apparently does not enjoy the buzz, Egyptian fruit bats. And they apparently deliberately avoid fruit which has started to ferment, and some Colombian researchers wanted to find out why they avoided the fermented fruit. So they set up a controlled enclosure which still allowed the bats to fly from one end to the other, and then started giving them progressively more alcoholic.
Oh, no. Basically, drinks? Wow.
Dosed food. They were giving him booze in various forms, but they basically wanted to see what was the effect of the ethanol on the performance of the bats. So what they discovered was that when bats have had a few, they flew more slowly from one end of the corridor to the other. And they put that down to the effects of the booze. They were slower moving. They also noted that the bats' echolocation system seemed to perform poorly in the bats that have been given more ethanol than the control group. So obviously this may seriously affect the bats' ability to forage for food, potentially make them more susceptible to predators and other, you know, dangers that come with drinking booze, basically. In other words, to any bats who may be listening, don't drink and fly. Just avoid that fermented fruit. But they naturally, apparently they naturally,
I mean,
smell it.
It sounds like they don't need the public service announcement. It sounds like they've already figured it out.
I figured it out. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Teetotaling bats already, apparently. So now the Ig Nobel Peace Prize was also alcohol related in that it followed up on anecdotal stories that people believe their language skills improve in a language other than their native language after they've had a few drinks. So this is something.
Oh, I mean, 100%. Not too many, though. Not too many.
Look, I was going to say, like, if not your language, actual speaking the language, your impersonation of the accent certainly improves.
Yeah. Or is it about the confidence?
This is something that needs to be tested, and it has been tested, of course, which is why it won the Ig Nobel Peace Prize. As the testimony of intoxicated people is less than reliable, the idea that language skills improve after alcohol consumption probably seems a little bit doubtful. Are you going to take the drunk's word for it that they're really smart and clever at things after they've had a few? Probably not. But some research in the UK were keen to find out for sure. So they took 50 German speakers who had recently learnt Dutch and gave them a conversational test with a native Dutch speaker. And then they repeated the test with some of the subjects consuming alcoholic drinks and some of them not. So it was a blinded study. And then those conversations were listened to by native Dutch speakers and assessed for accuracy and pronunciation. The listeners had no idea which conversations they'll listen to. They were grading blind and giving marks according to how well they performed in this language testing. So the German-speaking Dutch learners also assessed themselves for their performance, both before and after the drinks were administered. And what they found in this study was that, in fact, language skills did improve after people consumed alcohol. Now, I've got to say at this point, German and Dutch are not that different.
I was going to say that. It sounds like maybe a bit of a prejudice there, but really.
Possibly. But
if they're all doing, if they're all speaking the same language, I mean, that's a constant, right?
Well, yeah, it's all German speakers learning Dutch, so they are learning. But the Dutch and German languages are close enough that I reckon they learned it very easily, potentially. But that's not really the point of the test. The test is, did they improve after drinking booze? The answer is yes, they did. Both in the accuracy of the language used and in the accent and pronunciation of the Dutch language. So the listeners went, oh, yeah, they sound a lot more Dutch after they've had a few drinks, which is interesting.
We're assuming here that Dutch is not just drunk German.
I would never suggest such a thing.
No.
That remains to be seen. Further research required. The researchers attribute the improvement to a lowering of anxiety around speaking a new language, which allows them to relax their inhibitions around speaking another language and feel less self-conscious. And I know that myself, trying to learn another language, pronouncing things in the right accent is embarrassing because it's not your accent and you kind of feel like you might be impersonating someone or being a bit silly or something like that. So it does make a lot of sense that the alcohol lowers that inhibition, like it's well known to do. The one thing that didn't change after the alcohol was the self-assessment of the participants. Their assessments didn't change. They were the same sort of level they assumed that they were, whether they'd had drinks or not. So that was an interesting thing. There's no Dunning-Kruger at work here, apparently. So I think, you know, in the name of international communication, cheers to drinking while learning new languages.
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
Science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Okay, so the first winner of the Ig Nobel Prizes that I want to talk about today is the winner of the Pediatric Prize. And interestingly, this winner, as I alluded to in the introduction, it is not groundbreaking research from 2025. It is research that is, it's 34 years old. It was published in 1991. Way back.
That happens with the Nobel Prizes as well. Like it's...
Oh, it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the significance, not the...
it is the significance. Date. All right. And when I tell you what this research is, you'll see why it's so significant. So the study looked at the effects of mums eating garlic and what happens to the smell of her breast milk and the effect that it has on the suckling behaviour of her baby. So for any mums out there who have ever been like, oh, gosh, like they tell you all this stuff when you start breastfeeding, like, oh, like there are all these wives' tales about things you should eat, things you shouldn't eat, don't eat onions, don't eat garlic, it'll make your kid colicky and all this sort of stuff that's like there's no real basis for it. But this study looked at the behaviour and if you could actually smell it in the breast milk. It was a pretty small sample size. They had 8 mothers and babies in the study. And I guess it's also worth pointing out that it is 34 years old. So these suckling babies probably have babies of their own and are now 34 years old.
The babies might be listening to the show and going, hey, I was in that study.
I was in that study. Hey, that's me. So they collected the breast milk from the mothers initially, and then they got a panel of people with working noses to smell the milk at different intervals after they had a garlic sauce or some sort of they ate a lot of garlic. I don't actually know how they ate the garlic, whether it was like a particularly garlicky dip or like a hummus, or I don't know how they ate it. Maybe they just ate raw garlic. That sounds pretty gross to me. But anyway, they got these people to smell it and found that the breast milk smelled more and more like garlic and peaked at around 2 hours post garlic ingestion. And then started to drop off after that. So from that, they got this nice curve of, I guess, how the garlic sort of flows through to the breast milk. So then they started looking at the behavior of the babies over that time. So what do you think the babies did? Do you think they liked the garlic? Do you think that they exhibited behaviors that was like positive for the garlic or negative?
I wouldn't expect them to like the garlic myself.
Yeah. Because
then again.
But I mean, you like garlic, don't you?
Yeah. But still, I'm not a baby.
Yeah. But I mean, babies, what are they if not little people?
Very accurate description. The thing that I was thinking, though, is
you're a parent. You know they're not little people.
Mine's a fully grown people now, so they do turn out that way.
They do turn out that way.
I was just thinking though, if the baby gets bored of like same milk every day, same flavour, boring, and then it's like, garlic flavour.
Counter to that, and I mean, humans also drink cow's milk. Can you imagine garlic flavoured cow milk?
Yeah, I mean that's where my brain goes. Like milk and garlic sounds disgusting.
However, when you're
a baby and all you drink is milk, then a little bit of flavour I think is okay.
I mean, garlic flavored custard is the basis of French cookery, so let's just bear that in mind.
Okay. Well, I mean, the French were onto something because the babies liked it. And the babies at peak garlic time, the 2 hours after the garlic ingestion, they were attached to the breast for longer. They sucked more when the milk smelled like garlic. And there was even a tendency for them to drink more milk. So there you go. Babies love garlic. It's official. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
Yeah, I do know from like a dairy farming point of view that they don't like cows eating strongly flavored things because it does affect the flavor and the smell of the milk. But you know, that's a product rather than an individual choice. Whether
that's
the cows
right.
like it or not, or the calves like it or not, we'll never know because they're allowed to eat it.
Well, or maybe that'll be Ig Nobel Prize next year. Calf preference for garlic milk. So the other prize that caught my attention this year was the nutrition prize. Don't be deceived, though. This is no ordinary nutrition. This study was looking at the preferred pizza topping, not of humans, of the agama lizard, also known as the rainbow lizard. It's a very colourful, very common lizard. It's found in sub-Saharan Africa, around picnic areas and in towns. I remember it when I was there in Tanzania. It was like eating a lot of food from around the ground of a picnic area. So researchers from Italy decided they wanted to figure out what the key to the rainbow lizard's success was in cities and build up areas. So, and when they observed these lizards, that they actually sort of go into tourist areas and in this particular beachside town in Togo, they were going in and actually stealing pizzas from the tourists. So they started thinking, I wonder if pizza is their key to success. And if so, what kind of pizza? What topping is their preferred pizza? So they set up an experiment to see what pizza the lizards like best and what they shunned. I don't know if you want to have a guess about their favorite pizza.
Just tell
okay, it. I'm just going to tell you.
From no, just from my background reading, I do know that turtles living in the sewers of New York City prefer pepperoni pizza.
That's a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle joke.
So
there
might be the mutation, but
yes.
Just throwing it out there.
Okay, it wasn't pepperoni. It's four cheeses. Four cheeses pizza was the
Quattro
preferred.
Quattro Fabaggi, that's one of my favourites.
Quattro, you and the rainbow lizard, Chris. Who knew?
Well, in common, yeah.
Who knew? So Quattro Formaggio, and if I'm not, so there's what are the four cheeses? Parmesan, mozzarella, some sort of like soft cheese. And
I think
then,
Romano and Gorgonzola.
And Gorgonzola.
Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, when four cheeses was available for the lizards, like, all the lizards joined in. They were just like going crazy for it. Lizards had come down from the trees. Lizards from far and wide would get in on this four cheeses pizza. And, you know, they weren't a fan of all pizzas. Some of the pizzas they were like, there was this other one, it's called Four Seasons Pizza. So it's got like artichokes and mushrooms and olives of sort of like the four seasons of Italy, I presume. And they just did not want a bar of it. They didn't vibe on the mushrooms and the artichokes. They were just, but as soon as the four cheeses came out, bam, they were there. So, yeah, the researchers think it might be that the four cheese pizza has a stronger smell. Maybe it's the gorgonzola. Maybe it's the blue cheese that's attracted the lizards. And, as we all know, cheese, it's full of fat. So the lizards have certainly chosen the right pizza to, as the researchers say, enhance their body condition.
Just a quick question. Is there any garlic on the four cheese pizza?
I mean, presumably.
So garlic and milk.
Preference. It's a preference for lizards and baby humans. Anyway, lizards, baby humans, all of you, go get your dairy and live your best life.
All right, yes, now it's my turn to run down my stories that caught my eye. And I know we're doing like two stories each. I thought I would chuck in three stories because there's one that I wasn't going to cover, but I thought deserved to mention. It's the chemistry prize, which I won't go into great detail about. I don't know if you saw about this, but essentially it was some researchers who wanted to test whether basically Teflon, like bulking out food with Teflon, was a way to fill people up. I see, without changing the calorie content of the food, just make it more filling. And
that is wild.
Well, I mean, obviously they chose Teflon because Teflon is meant to be an inert chemical, and hence the use of it. But the reason this one caught my eye is because Teflon is technically a PFAS chemical. So I think in the current environment, trying to convince people to eat lots of PFAS, probably not a selling point.
It's also, I mean, you know, putting Teflon in food is not going to be popular with toilet paper manufacturers.
Oh, my God.
No, no, we'll leave that one there. No, so another one I want to talk about, pardon me, was the biology prize. I might only give this one a brief mention as well, because this is a story that I've actually covered on the show, I think a couple of times in the history of Lost in Science, but I've been doing this a long time. And it essentially goes back to the question of why zebras have stripes. Does anybody want to hazard a guess of why zebras have stripes?
I remember your stories on why zebras have stripes, and we talked through that it was like a camouflage thing, and then there was the idea that maybe it wasn't a camouflage thing, but it was there was a like an air pressure thing to keep them cooler or something, and then there was a wasn't there something to do with the flies?
Yeah, so look, the camouflage thing has been pretty much debunked. For various reasons, including that, like the lions and hyenas are kind of the main predators of the zebras, and they will attack them from a distance for starters. So where the stripes are kind of less relevant, but also lions in particular tend to hunt at night. And so the idea that they're for a long way away, there it's nighttime, the effectiveness of stripes for predation, protecting from predators is probably not a great help. I mean, they're not exactly hiding in long grass, these zebras. So it's, yeah, that one's pretty much debunked. So the two main hypotheses are the thermoregulation or the fly protection. The thermoregulation is the idea that the black stripes and the white stripes, you know, have a temperature difference between them. They absorb heat different ways, and that maybe makes air currents help cool them off. The fly one is a bit more complicated because no one quite knows the mechanism. There's something you might do with, like, some flies have use polarized light in their vision. But again, it's not clear. This research that won the Ig Nobel Prize is related to the flies. It is one that I think I covered the last time I did this story, so because it dates back a fair while to 2019, where some researchers basically they painted cows in Japan with zebra stripes. To see whether that would protect them from flies. And it did. It did protect them from flies. The question remains, A, whether Japanese flies are the same as African flies. But also some people have studied, you know, the prevalence of zebra stripes versus the patterns of zebra stripes versus fly distribution. And it is the jury is still out. There is no consensus on this hypothesis. So look, this is amusing because they painted cows, I guess is the main thing. But it has not proven the case one way or another. People are still hotly debating the zebras. Or hot and cold. It goes hot and cold, I guess, depending on how you want to do it. So of course the final prize I thought I'd chat out, me being me, of course I'm going to mention the physics prize, which this year was awarded to some Italian physicists who basically did a study on, I don't want to be stereotyped here. What do you think the Italian physicists studied?
Was it rainbow lizards?
No, you're still right. It was pasta. We already covered the pizza. And they studied pasta. Essentially, the story that they told is that they were kind of away from home. They were all getting together and, you know, trying to make pasta to memories of home and trying to get it right. And in particular, one type of pasta, which is cacio e pepe, apologies for pronunciation, which is basically cheese and pepper, and trying to work out how you make a cheese and pepper sauce without the cheese kind of separating, coming into lumps, essentially. What they call the mozzarella phase is where the cheese joins up into big clumps.
Because it's an easy recipe to make, but the ingredients are simple, but it's difficult to actually get right.
Yeah. And the details, look, I mean, this is the kind of story that I would normally do, I think, on this show, and I would try to make it and demonstrate it. But I read the paper and it's more complicated than I thought. Essentially, what it comes down to is that, the cheese is kind of, it's emulsified in the mixture with the pasta. And the starch from, so you normally add some water from cooking the pasta that helps stabilize the emulsion. And so having some starch there helps keep the cheese from clumping. And the more starch, the more protective it is of this clumping from the cheese. The better the cheese kind of makes it kind of a creamy quality. There is a limit, though, that if you have too much starch, it starts to get all kind of too stiff and that sort of thing. So in part of this paper, they worked out the ideal mixture of starch with cheese to get the working. Now, traditional recipes often, like I said, they'll use the pasta water. Just plain pasta water that you cook the pasta in is not sufficient.
Mm.
So usually they will boil it down a little bit to get like a more concentrated starch. For the purposes of their idealized scientific recipe, they just mix, so you know, potato starch or corn starch into water to get the right concentration of it.
Right.
You know, apparently the nonnas can do it. No, just by practice. But yeah, so if you want to check out the paper, they do have the recipe for an ideal cacio e pepe. It is, like I said, it's more complicated, but it's a good thing to learn if you were to make these traditional Italian things yourself. And the magic of starch, I didn't realize that starch was such an important part of it. You know, normally you just add the pasta water in these recipes. You think, oh, just a bit of, I don't know, spaghetti flavor or something. But it's actually, the starch is an important part of making the sauce. And so, important to bear in mind of what is going on. Cooking is complicated, and that's why I love these science of cooking stories.
And that's all we have time for on another episode of Lost in Science. Thanks for listening. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the Ngunnawal people, and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the kind support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you would like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at lostinsci@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Lost in Science on 3CR, or you can just tune in wherever you find us, on your radio, on your podcast. Next week, when Chris, Stu, Lyndon, and Claire get Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.